the thing, but he knew he was nearly out of blades. When they were gone, he would have only one weapon left, a Seraph blade. It would not be enough to protect himself and Grace, nor could they run. The demons would easily catch them. Two creatures dived for them. James hurled his last blade, dispatching one Cerberus demon in a rain of ichor. The other fell beside it, cloven in two by a dainty throwing axe. James froze. He knew that axe. Whirling, he saw Lucy running full tilt toward him from the road, and she was not alone. Cordelia was there, Cortana gleaming in her hand. Matthew was beside her, armed with Indian shalikars, circular throwing knives edged with razor-sharp steel. Then came Christopher with two crackling Seraph blades, and Thomas wielding his bolas. One flick of the ropes, and one twist of Thomas's powerful arm, and a demon sailed clear off the bridge and into the river. Alistair Carstairs was also with them. As James stared, he leaped onto the iron railing of the bridge, balancing just as James and Matthew had once done in practice. A long-bladed spear was in his hand. Two sweeps sliced one of the creatures in half. It exploded into nothingness, splattering Alistair with ichor, which struck James as a positive development on two fronts. Alistair leaped down from the railing with a disgusted noise and charged into the fray. As the shadow hunters spread out around them, a cry rose from the demons, a thick, clogged sound. If a corpse rotting in the dirt had a sound, James thought, that was what it would have been. He sprang backward, swung around, and delivered a spinning kick to an oncoming demon. There was a blur of gold and the demon vanished. James looked up to see Cordelia standing over him, Cortana in her hand. Its blade was smeared with demon blood. There was no time to thank her. Another demon lunged. James seized his Seraph blade. "Zerachiel!" he cried, and the blade became a wand of fire. His friends were in the thick of battle, save Grace, who had backed away, clutching the dagger. James spared a bitter thought for Tatiana, who had never been willing to let Grace train to fight, before spinning to fend off a reaching demon. Before he could, a crackling Seraph blade sliced sideways into the creature's flesh. It hopped back, hissing like a pot on the boil, leaving James with a clear line of sight to Christopher. He stood, holding the Seraph blade, which sputtered like a frying potato. "Christopher!" said James. "What is that thing?" "A Seraph blade. I have tried to enhance it with electricity." "Does that work?" "Not at all," confessed Christopher, just as a demon flew shrieking at his face. He stabbed it, but the Seraph blade leaped with an erratic line of fire. Lucy and Thomas were both there before the demon could touch Christopher, Lucy's axe and Thomas's bolas almost meeting in the creature's flesh. It winked out of existence, but another took its place immediately, rising above them like a menacing cloud. Abandoning the Seraph blade, Christopher seized a dagger from the inside of his waistcoat and stabbed it into the creature. It staggered back, just at the moment that a long spear soared through the fog and slammed into it. It folded like a letter and vanished, leaving a smear of ichor behind. James looked over wildly and saw Alistair Carstairs, holding a matching spear in his left hand and looking thoughtfully at the spot from which the demon had just vanished. "You're carrying spears?" James demanded. "I never leave the house without my spears," cried Alistair, causing them all to stare, even Grace. James had questions, but no chance to ask them. He heard his sister shout, and he dashed forward only to find Lucy and Cordelia fighting back to back, a dagger in Lucy's hand and Cortana in Cordelia's. Cortana formed a wide golden sweep, and every creature who managed to sneak past Cordelia's guard, Lucy stabbed. Matthew stood atop the railing, hurling one shalikar after another, to provide cover for the girls. A demon loomed suddenly behind Thomas, whose bolus was wrapped around another demon, possibly around its throat, though with these creatures it was hard to tell.
"Lightwood!" shouted Alistair. "Behind you!"
James knew it was Alistair, because nobody else would be such a fool as to shout that in the middle of a fight. Of course Christopher turned, and of course Thomas, who the shout was aimed at, did not. James dived for Thomas, rolling on the ground to reach him faster, just as the demon lunged. Its teeth and claws raked Thomas's arm, drawing blood. There was no room for Thomas to use his bolus. He yelled and punched the demon. It staggered, and James, rising to his feet, stabbed it through the back. But there was no time to rest. More demons had come. Matthew leaped down from the railing and ran toward them. He threw himself to the ground and slid the last few feet across the wet pavement, a great sacrifice for Matthew, who loved his clothes, hurling a shalika into the mass of demons. One went down, but there seemed a dozen others. Alistair was hurling spears with deadly accuracy. Cordelia was laying about her with Cortana like a warrior goddess. They were all fighting well, and yet... The largest demon rose up in front of James. Without a second's hesitation, he plunged his seraph blade into the creature. Ichor splashed black against his hand, spattering the ground at his feet. The demon gurgled and seemed to crumple, its frog-like legs giving out under it. James raised his blade to dispatch it, just as it looked up at him, with its deadly black eyes. He saw himself reflected in those eyes, as if they were mirrors. He saw his own black hair, his pale face, the gold of his pupils. He saw the same expression he had seen on the face of the Dumas in the alleyway near Fleet Street. Recognition.
"Herondale boy,"
the demon said, in a voice like the last hiss of dying fire in a grate.
"I know you. I know all about you. The blood of demons burns in your veins. Why would you slay those who worship your mother's father? Why destroy your own kind?"
James froze. He could see several of the others twist look over at him. Matthew looked furious, the others horrified. Lucy had her hand over her mouth. Alistair, who stood the closest to him, was staring with wide, dark eyes. James exhaled a shuddering breath. "I am not your kind," he said.
"You do not know what you are."
"Enough," James thought. "This is enough." "If you worship my grandfather," he said savagely, "then go, in his name, not back to Chiswick House, back to the dimension you came from." The demon hesitated, and as it did, all the other demons went still. Every figure at the riverside was turned toward James.
"We will go then, as you say, to show that we honour your blood," said the demon. "But there is one condition. If you or your friends speak a word of what happened here, tonight, to any member of the Clave, we will return, and your families will pay in blood and death for your betrayal."
"Don't you dare," James began. The demon grinned.
"In the name of Hell's most cunning prince," it said,
in a voice so low that only James could hear it. Then it vanished. They all vanished. As quickly as the world had exploded into motion and noise, it went still again. James could hear the river, the harsh breath of Alistair nearby, the pounding of his own heart. He dropped his still-burning blade to the ground. He saw Lucy and Cordelia lower their weapons. Thomas and Matthew staggered to their feet. There was a cut along Matthew's face, and Thomas's shirt was torn, his arm bleeding badly. They were all staring at James. he felt numb. He had known his grandfather was a greater demon, but princes of hell were another matter. They were fallen angels, as powerful as Raziel, but evil and rotten to the core. Hell's most cunning prince. He couldn't help but look at Lucy, but it was clear she hadn't heard the demon's final words. She was smiling and saying something to Cordelia. Demons lied. Why should Lucy have to torment herself over a possible untruth? His mind raced ahead. He had to talk to Uncle Jem again, as soon as possible. Jem was the one who had been looking for their grandfather. Jem would know what to do. It was Christopher who broke the silence. What just happened?
Demons vanished, said Matthew, dabbing blood from his face. The leader seemed to feel it was an old friend of James's grandfather.
Oh, the demony grandfather, said Christopher.
Yes, obviously the demony one, Christopher, said James.
The other one's Welsh, said Thomas, as if this explained things. He directed this statement in Alistair and Cordelia's direction.
No need to explain about Herondale, said Alistair with an unpleasant smile. I imagine this happens to him fairly often. Cordelia stepped on his foot. Grace had emerged from the shadows. She walked toward the rest of the group, her hands clasped in front of her, her face white and stiff.
I'm sorry. I don't know how to fight.
It's all right, James said. It's all right. We'll get you trained properly.
James! Grace!
It was Lucy. She gestured toward the road. A second later, James heard jingling and saw an old-fashioned pony trap emerging from the fog, drawn by two scrawny brown horses. Sitting in the trap was Tatiana Blackthorne. She pulled up short and leaped down from the carriage. As always, she presented a bizarre appearance. She was wearing a costume with full skirts and fussy lace, a dress from another age made for a much younger and plumper girl. On her head was a hat piled high with false fruit and stuffed birds. It trembled with her rage as she raked the group with her furious gaze, which came to rest on her daughter.
Grace, she snapped, get into the trap. Now.
Grace turned to James. Her face was white. In a low voice, he said, You do not need to do as she says. Come back to the Institute with me. I beg of you. Grace's face was still tear-stained, but her expression had closed like a bank vault.
James, I cannot. Walk me to the carriage, please.
James hesitated.
Please, she said. I mean what I say.
Reluctantly, James held out his arm for Grace to take. He saw Tatiana's lips tighten into a thin line. James waited for her to snap, but she stayed silent. She had clearly not expected so many shadow hunters there, and so many from the families she hated. Herondales, Lightwoods, Carstairs. She would wish to be gone as soon as possible, James suspected. She glared daggers at James as he walked to the carriage, supporting Grace on his arm. He helped her in and she sank back against the seat, her eyes closing wearily. James wished he could say something to her about the argument they'd had earlier. He and Grace had never argued before. He wanted to beg her not to go back to Chiswick House, but he suspected it would only make things worse for her if he did. I will write to you tomorrow, he began.
No, Grace said through white lips. No, I require some time, James. I will write to you.
That's enough, hissed Tatiana, shooing James away from the carriage. Leave my daughter alone, Herondale. I don't need you luring her into trouble.
The only trouble we encountered was your family's Cerberus demons, said James in a low, furious tone.
I suggest you cease with your threats, unless you wish me to tell the Clave about them.
He couldn't tell anyone, of course, given the demon's threat, but Tatiana didn't know that. Not that it mattered. A low chuckle bubbled its way up from her throat. "My demons," she echoed. "And where are they now, Herondale?" "Dead," James said shortly. "We killed them." "How impressive," she said. "Tattle away, boy. I'll tell the Clave Grace raised the demons herself. I'll tell them she's deep in black magic studies up to her pretty little ears. I'll turn her loose and throw her back on their mercy with her reputation stained forever. I'll ruin her life, if you want to play that game." She jabbed a finger toward his chest. "You care, Herondale. That is your weakness." James stepped back in revulsion as Tatiana clambered into the trap. A moment later, it was rattling off down the road, the ponies snorting and the reins jangling. There was a long and awkward silence as the group of shadow hunters watched the Blackthorn carriage vanish into the fog. "Well," said Alistair at last, "I think it's time for Cordelia and I to be going." "I cannot go yet," said Cordelia. She held out her arm and saw her brother's eyes widen. A long, bloody cut ran from her elbow to her wrist. She had barely felt it during the battle, but it was beginning to sting. "I need a healing rune. If I return home like this, Mother will faint." "Several of us are wounded," said Christopher, "unless we want to explain what happened here, and it seems that would be a bad idea. We should probably apply Eratzes." He turned to Thomas. "I will do yours." "Please don't," said Thomas. Christopher did not always have the best of luck with runes. "Oh, bloody hell, I'll do it," said Alistair, and stomped heavily over to Thomas's side. Thomas watched in what seemed to be shock as Alistair produced a steely and began to draw on the bare skin of his arm where his shirt had been torn. Beside Cordelia, Lucy produced her steely with a flourish. "Our first healing rune," she announced, putting the tip of the steely to Cordelia's wrist. "A historic moment for a pair of soon-to-be famous parabatai."
"I hate to seem ungrateful for the assistance," said James, "but what on earth brought you all here? How did you know what was going to happen?"
"I heard about the Cerberus from Jessamine," said Lucy, putting the finishing touches on Cordelia's rune. They were both leaning against the low wall that ran along the embankment.
"Ghosts, they gossip."
She repeated for James the story she told the rest of them on the way to Chelsea, finishing with,
"So it seems the demon you killed in the greenhouse had time to multiply, and the new demons came looking for Grace when she left Chiswick."
"There were certainly a lot of them," said Cordelia, "much worse than just the one in the greenhouse."
"Perhaps they all had secret assignations with Grace," said Lucy.
Alistair snorted. "That Blackthorn woman must be mad, letting Cerberus demons run wild in her shrubberies," he said, putting his steely away. Thomas touched his own arm with a sort of wondering look. His wound was already beginning to close up. Alistair might be snappish, but he was handy with a steely. James and Matthew had sat on the ground so James could properly steady Matthew's face with his hand. He drew an Eratzes lightly on his cheek while Matthew squirmed and complained.
"It's hard to say how much she knew," James said.
"I'm sure she was aware of the original demon in the greenhouse, but likely not its vengeful progeny."
"She knew enough to come here," Christopher pointed out, "though she may just have been following Grace."
James looked thoughtful. Cordelia could not help but wonder what Tatiana had said to him by the pony trap. He had looked stunned, as if she had hit him in the face.
"They disappeared because you told them to, didn't they?" Cordelia said.
"So it seems."
James was examining Matthew's cheek, apparently considering his rune work. Satisfied, he sat back.
Matthew produced a flask from his pocket with a relieved air, unscrewed the top, and took a long drink. They went back to whatever dimensions Cerberus demons hail from. In the name of my grandfather. He sounded bitter. How nice for you to be related to such an important sort of demon, said Alistair dryly. If it actually cared that James was related to an important demon, it should have said something to me too, said Lucy. I am his sister. I do not appreciate being overlooked. James smiled, which, Cordelia suspected, had been Lucy's aim. He had a perfectly lethal dimple that flashed when he smiled. Such things should be illegal. They're loyal to the Blackthorn family in their horrid sort of way, said Lucy thoughtfully. That's why they wanted us not to say anything about what happened tonight.
Ah, said Alistair, because the Clave wouldn't look too kindly on the Blackthorns breeding a pack of Cerberus demons and letting them chase after Herondale, even though he is very irritating.
I told you, Benedict Lightwood was the one that bred them, Lucy said crossly.
Unpleasant as all that was, Matthew said, there is something comforting about fighting the ordinary kind of demon under cover of darkness, rather than poisonous ones that appear during the day.
Oh, said Cordelia, that reminds me. We should tell them what Hypatia said, Matthew, that we could speak to Ragnar Fell about the demons in the park.
Everyone started to sputter questions. Matthew held up a hand. Yes, we spoke to Hypatia Vex at the Hell Ruel. She said she would send Ragnar a message. It is hardly a sure thing.
Perhaps, but Anna was right, said Cordelia. We must speak to more downworlders regardless. There was much talk of Magnus Bane.
Ah, Magnus Bane, said Matthew. My personal hero. Indeed. You once described him as Oscar Wilde if he had magic powers, said James.
Magnus Bane threw a party in Spain I attended, said Thomas. It was a little difficult, since I did not know a soul. I got rather drunk.
Matthew lowered the flask with a grin. Is that where you got your tattoo?
Lucy clapped her hands.
The boys joke about the tattoo Thomas got in Spain, but Thomas will never let me see it. Isn't that the meanest thing you ever heard, Cordelia? I am a writer. I believe I should have the experience of studying a tattoo at close quarters.
I believe you shouldn't, said Thomas with conviction.
Is the problem that it is in an unmentionable place? Asked Lucy.
No, Lucy, said Thomas with a hunted air.
I'd like to see it, said Alistair, in a surprisingly quiet voice.
Thomas hesitated, then unbuttoned the shirt sleeve of his unwounded arm and rolled it up to his elbow. Everyone leaned forward. Against the pale skin on the inside of Thomas's muscular arm was a grey and black tracery of a compass. North, south, east and west were delineated by blades like the points of daggers, and at the heart of the compass, unfurling dark petals, was a rose. Cordelia had thought a tattoo would be rather more like their marks, but it reminded her of something else instead. It was ink, the way books and poems were made of ink, telling a permanent story. Lucy applauded. Alistair made an odd sort of noise. He was looking away, as if the sight of Thomas bothered him.
I think it's lovely, Thomas, Cordelia said. North points up your arm, along the vein that runs to your heart.
So does that mean you're close friends with Magnus Bane, Thomas? Said Lucy. Can you reach out to him for help?
He never even made an appearance at the party, said Thomas, rolling his sleeve down. But reaching out to Ragnar Fell is a good idea. As long as he will keep all this to himself, said Christopher, pushing his spectacles up the bridge of his nose. We cannot tell any shadow hunters what happened here tonight. We all heard what that demon said.
There was a murmur of assent, broken by Alistair.
Cordelia and I must depart, he said.
As for your little secrets, you cannot trust demons. It does not matter what they claim. Cordelia knew that tone in his voice.
Alistair, you must promise to keep everything that happened here tonight to yourself.
Why should I promise? Alistair demanded. Because even if demons are liars, the risk is too great, said Cordelia, a little desperately. The demons said it would target our families if any of us spoke of what happened tonight. Think of mother and father.
Alistair looked mutinous.
If you do not promise, Cordelia added, I will not go home with you. I will stay out all night and be utterly ruined. I will have to marry Thomas or Christopher.
What ho? Said Christopher, looking surprised.
Thomas smiled.
If you have any concern for our family, you must promise, Cordelia said. Please, Alistair.
There was a murmur all around. Lucy looked worried. James was looking at Cordelia with an expression she could not decipher.
Alistair's eyes narrowed. Very well, I promise, he muttered. Now come away at once. We have much to discuss when we return home.
It was nearing midnight when the five of them, Lucy, James, Matthew, Thomas, and Christopher, finally returned to the Institute. Lucy regarded the bright-lit windows curiously as they spilled into the courtyard. It was unusual at this hour for all the lamps to be on. James lifted a finger to his lips before pushing open the wide front doors. They opened to the touch of any shadow hunter's hand and led the way inside and up the stairs. The first floor hallway shimmered with witch lights. The door of the parlour stood open and the sound of a Welsh song rang out into the corridor.
Nidwyn gofyn bawed moethus, a'r y byd na'i bela man, gofyn wyf am golyn hapus, calon honest, calon lan.
James and Lucy exchanged a worried look. If Will was singing, that meant he was in a sociable mood, and would seize them the moment he saw them and begin reminiscing about whales and ducks.
Perhaps, said James in a whisper, we should all swiftly exit and ascend to an upper chamber using a window and a grappling hook.
Tessa appeared in the doorway of the drawing room. At the sight of all five of them, she raised her eyebrows. Lucy and James exchanged a glance, too late for the grappling hook. Lucy stepped forward and slid an arm around her mother's waist.
Sorry, ma'am. We had a late picnic down by the river. Are we in trouble?
Tessa smiled. You are all scamps, but I hope you enjoyed yourselves. We can discuss this later. Your father has a guest. Go in and introduce yourselves. I'll just pop up to the infirmary and be back. James led their expedition into the parlour, Thomas, Matthew and Christopher all murmuring their greetings to Tessa as they passed. In the parlour, sitting upon two matched grey velvet wing-backed chairs, were Will and a tall green warlock with horns curling in his snowy hair. He wore a dour expression. Will made the introductions.
Ragnar Fell, my beloved son and daughter, also a disgraceful pack of home invaders. I think you all know Ragnar Fell, the former High Warlock of London.
He taught us in the academy, Christopher said.
Ragnar Fell glared at him.
By the name of Lilith, he drawled, hide the breakables, hide the whole house. Christopher Lightwood is here.
Christopher is often here, said James. The house remains mostly intact.
Will grinned.
Mr. Fell is here on a social call, he said. Isn't that nice?
Will had tried to make clear that the Institute's doors were open to downworlders, but few had ever taken him up on that hospitality. Will and Henry talked often of Magnus Bane, but Bane had been in America Lucy's whole life.
Mr. Fell expressed a keen interest in Welsh music, so I sang a few songs, said Will.
Also, we've had a few glasses of port. We've been enjoying ourselves. I have been here for hours, said Ragnar in a dolorous voice. There have been many songs. I know you enjoyed them, said Will. His eyes were sparkling. Far above them, Lucy heard an odd sound, as if something in the house had tipped over and crashed. Perhaps a lamp. I do feel as if I have been to Wales and back, said Ragnar. His eyes lit on Matthew. The consul's son, he said. I remember you. Your mother is a kind woman. Has she quite gotten over her illness? That was some years ago, Matthew said. He attempted a smile and failed. Lucy bit her lip. Few knew that Charlotte had been quite ill when Matthew was 15, and she had lost a baby she was carrying. Poor Matthew, to be so reminded. Matthew walked over to the mantel and poured himself a glass of sherry with slightly trembling hands. Lucy saw Will's eyes follow Matthew, but before he could speak, the parlour door opened and Tessa appeared, carrying a lighted taper. Her face was in shadow. Wilbach, she said in a low voice, come with me for a moment. I have something to ask you. Will sprang to his feet with alacrity. He always did when Tessa was the one who called him away. Lucy knew the love her parents shared was an extraordinary one. It was the kind of love she tried to capture in the pages of her own writing, but she could never find the right words. As soon as the door shut behind Lucy's parents, Ragnar Fell wheeled on James. I see this generation of shadow hunters has no more sense than the last, he said sharply. Why are you gallivanting around London town at this time of night when I need to speak with you? What, and interrupt your social call? Said James, grinning. Father said you were listening to Welsh songs for hours. Yes, more's the pity. Ragnar made an impatient gesture. My friend Hypatia let me know that some young shadow hunters came to her salon tonight, asking questions about unusual demons and hinting at a dire future for us all. She mentioned your name. He stabbed a finger in Matthew's direction. She said she owed you lot some sort of debt and asked if I could help. Will you? Thomas spoke for the first time since they had entered the parlour. My sister is one of the wounded. Ragnar looked astonished. Thomas Lightwood? Lord, you're huge. What have the Nephilim been feeding you? I grew a little, Thomas said, impatient. Can you help Barbara? The Silent Brothers have put all those injured to sleep, but so far there is no cure. Thomas gripped the wooden back of a chair, carved to represent crossed seraph blades. His skin was tanned, but he held the chair so hard his hands were white. Ragnar Fell surveyed the room, his pale eyebrows raised. The scarcity of demons in London over the past years has not escaped my notice, he said. I have also heard the rumours that a powerful warlock is behind this absence. Do you believe it? Said Lucy. No. If we warlocks could easily keep demons out of our cities, we would do it. But it would not require a powerful warlock so much as a corrupt one to play with this kind of magic. What do you mean? Said James. Surely keeping demons away is a good thing, not a bad one. Ragnar nodded his shaggy head slowly. One would think, he said. And yet what we are seeing here is that someone has cleared the minor demons out of London in order to make a path for those even more dangerous. Ragnar hesitated. Among warlocks, my name is often invoked when dimensional magic is spoken of. The most difficult and unstable kind of magic, the kind that involves other worlds than ours. I have made myself a student of it, and none knows more than I. Demons cannot appear in daylight. It is a rule of nature. And yet, are there ways to bring demons into this world that would make them impervious to it? Yes, Lucy hazarded. Ragnar glared. Don't expect me to tell you what they are, he said. only that they are forbidden by the spiral labyrinth, for they involve complex dimensional magic that presents a danger to the fabric of the world itself. He shook his white mane of hair. I do not have solid information, only rumours and guesses. I would not betray one of my own kind to a member of the Clave unless I knew for certain that they were guilty of a crime, for the Clave would arrest them first and examine the evidence later. But you, you are children, not yet in the Clave. If you were to look into this... We won't tell Father anything you don't want us to, James promised. We won't tell anyone. We swear it on Raziel's name. Except Cordelia, said Lucy hurriedly. She is to be my para batai. I cannot hide things from her. But we will not tell anyone else, and certainly not a single adult. There was a murmur as the others promised along with her. To swear something for a shadow hunter was a serious thing. To swear on the name of the angel was even more serious. Ragnar turned to James. Few warlocks could perform this magic, and even fewer would be willing. In fact, I can only think of one so corrupt. Emmanuel Gast. Word among the warlocks is, if the price is high enough, there is no work too low for him. I do not know if the rumour is true, but I do know his address. Ragnar went to the writing desk in the corner of the room and scratched the address down upon a sheet of paper. Lucy stared at the waterman's gold-embossed fountain pen in Ragnar Fell's heavy hands, an extra joint on each finger making the shadow of his hand upon the page seem almost a claw. Thank you, said James when the warlock was done. I don't suppose I need to ask you not to tell Gast who sent you, he said, straightening up from the desk. If I find out you did, I shall turn you all into a matched set of teacups. As for me, I am going to Capri. My nerves are in a state. If London is to be devoured by demons, I do not wish to be present for the event. Good luck to you all. This seemed an odd attitude for a former high warlock, but Lucy kept her mouth shut as Fell made his way to the door. She thought he might leave without another word, but he lingered a moment. I do not entirely know how to treat you, Herondales, he admitted. A warlock has never had a child before. I cannot help but wonder, what will you become? He looked steadily at James, and then at Lucy. The fire crackled in the grate, but neither of them spoke. Lucy thought of the demon at the bridge, telling James it would honour his blood. Her blood. Ragnar shrugged. So be it, he said, and left. Lucy dashed over to the writing desk and seized the piece of paper in her hands, then spun around, smiling. Thomas and James returned her smile, Thomas with hope, James with weariness. Matthew was gazing bleakly at the glass in his hand. Then the door opened, and Will and Tessa came in. Lucy, worried for an instant that they had heard some betraying hint of Ragnarfell's information, tucked the paper quickly into the pocket of her walking dress. Then she caught sight of their faces, and everything else was forgotten. It was like the end of summer in Idris. One day she and James would be playing in the forest among the green trees and mossy dells of flowers. Then would come an almost imperceptible change in the air, and she would know. There would be frost tomorrow. Thomas backed up, his face turning white beneath his tan. His shoulders struck Matthew's and the glass fell from Matthew's hands. It shattered at their feet, scattering shards across the hearth. There would be no more waiting for frost, Lucy thought. It was here. Thomas, we are so sorry, said Tessa, reaching out her hands. Your parents are on their way. Barbara has died. 11. Talismans and Spells. Knowledge is proud that he has learned so much. Wisdom is humble that he knows no more. Books are not seldom talismans and spells. William Cowper. The Task, Book 6. Winter Walk at Noon. The Tudig is cold.
Sonar towered in the doorway of the townhouse, her arms crossed as she glared at her two children.
Risa set supper out more than 2 hours ago. Where have you been?
We went to the infirmary at the Institute, lied Alistair, his eyes wide and innocent. He truly was the son of a Persian mother with a temper, Cordelia thought with some amusement. She had patted down her hair and skirts in the carriage as much as she was able, but she was well aware she looked a fright.
We thought we would bring flowers to show our concern as part of the London community.
Some of the anger went out of Sonar's face.
Those poor children in the sick room, she said.
She stood back and ushered them inside.
Come in, then, and take your shoes off before you get mud on the rugs.
Supper was a swift affair of cold tadig and koresh badamjan. By the end of it, Sonar had been convinced that the idea of helping out at the infirmary had been hers.
You're a good boy, Alistair June,
she said, kissing him on the top of his head as she rose from the table.
And you too, Cordelia. Though you should not have picked the flowers yourself. Your dress is ruined. So much mud.
She shook her head.
Good, said Cordelia. It's a horrid dress.
Sonar looked hurt.
When I was your age, she began.
This, Cordelia knew, presaged a story about how when Sonar had been a girl, she had been perfectly obedient to her parents, a dutiful shadow hunter, and had always kept her clothes in pristine condition. Alistair tossed his napkin onto the table.
Our Leila looks exhausted, he said.
Helping the ill is very tiring. I'll see her upstairs. There were three floors to the townhouse, the upper floor given over to Alistair's and Cordelia's bedrooms and a small study. Diamond-paned windows looked over the dark sky above Kensington. Alistair paused at the top of the stairs and leaned against the damask wallpaper.
Let's never talk to those terrible people ever again, he said.
He was twirling one of his Chinese spears between his fingers, its leaf-shaped blade catching the light that seeped up from downstairs. Alistair had a collection of spears, some of which folded up and could be kept in his pockets, several of which were secured in his coat lining.
I like them, Cordelia said crossly. All of them.
She could hear her mother singing to herself in her bedroom. A long time ago, Alistair himself had often sung and played the piano. Once they had been a musical family. Once things had been very different. Tonight had reminded Cordelia of when she and her brother were children and co-conspirators, as isolated siblings often were. Of the time before Alistair went to school and came back so very hard to reach.
Really? Alistair inquired. Which one do you find so agreeable? If it's Herondale, he will never like you better than Miss Blackthorne, and if it's Fairchild, he will never like you better than the bottle.
Cordelia's lips tightened.
Whether you like them or not, they are influential people.
And I'd prefer to think you're keeping our father's well-being foremost in your mind.
Alistair snorted.
Your plan is to save father by making people like you?
Clearly, you have never thought making people like you was important, Alistair, but I am not like that.
Alistair looked startled but recovered quickly.
You should think less about making people like you and more about making them owe you.
Alistair.
But someone was rapping on the door downstairs. The sound rang in the silence. Whoever was outside knocked 3 times in quick succession, then stopped. Alistair's expression changed.
We've spoken of this enough. Good night, Cordelia.
Not Leila anymore. Cordelia. His expression was stern as he turned to hasten downstairs. Cordelia reached out and grasped his coat.
Who could be visiting so late? Do you think it's bad news?
Alistair started, seeming astonished that Cordelia was still present, and his coat slipped through her fingers.
I know who it is. I will manage the situation. Go to bed at once, Cordelia,
Alistair ordered, not meeting her eyes.
If Mother catches you out of bed, there will be the devil to pay and no pitch hot.
He dashed down the steps. Cordelia leaned over the banister. Two floors down, she could see the encaustic tiles of their hall, the newly painted surfaces portraying yellow starbursts shining through a maze of swords. She saw her brother open the door and saw the shadow cast on the swords and stars as their visitor walked in. The man removed his hat. With some surprise, Cordelia recognized Charles Fairchild. Alistair glanced around worriedly, but it seemed clear that both their mother and Risa had gone to sleep. He took Charles's hat and coat, and they headed together toward the drawing room. Cordelia's heart was pounding. Charles Fairchild. Charles, who had told James not to venture near Grace. Charles, who Matthew clearly did not trust, but who Alistair clearly did. Alistair had promised her he would not tell James's secrets. He had promised. But he had not wanted to make the promise. Cordelia bit her lip, swore under her breath, and started down the steps. The stairs in their new home were oak, painted grey with a yellow runner up the centre, and a wrought iron railing painted grey as well. Cordelia wrestled with her conscience as she ran down them lightly, her stockinged feet making no sound. There was a back entrance to the drawing room. Cordelia slipped through the dining room, where the plates were still on the table, and down a servant's corridor. At the end of the hall was the door to the drawing room, already slightly ajar. She pressed herself up against it, peering through the crack. She could just see Charles warming his hands at the fire crackling in the white plaster grate. His red hair looked dark in the low light and very orderly. As Cordelia watched, Alistair stepped closer to Charles. Now she could see her brother fully. He was running his fingers through his tangled hair in a hopeless attempt to make it lie flat. Alistair. Charles turned so his back was to the fire. Why are you looking astate? What happened?
I went to find you earlier today, Alistair said.
There was a sulky note in his voice that surprised Cordelia.
My sister was with Anna. I went to your house and even to your club. Where were you?
I was at the Institute, of course. My fiancé remains ill, unless you've forgotten.
I would be very unlikely, said Alistair coldly, to forget your fiancé.
In the shadows, Cordelia blinked in confusion. Did Alistair not like Ariadne? She did not recall him mentioning her before.
Alistair, said Charles in a warning tone, we've discussed this. You said it would be temporary. A temporary political engagement. But I have spoken with Ariadne, Charles. She very much believes this marriage will happen.
Alistair had been standing close to Charles, so close their shadows touched. Now he turned his back on Charles and walked over to the bookcases. Cordelia tried to move back and nearly stepped on her dress. Fortunately, Alistair stopped before he could have seen her and stared at the books blankly. Cordelia had rarely seen such misery on his face.
This is not fair to her, Charles, said Alistair, or to me. Ariadne does not care what I do. Her interests lie elsewhere.
Charles paused for the briefest of moments.
She will gratify her parents with a good match, and I will find it useful to be connected to the Inquisitor. If I become consul, I could do so much good for the Clave, as well as for you. My mother is too sentimental, but I can make our people strong again. It is what I have wanted all my life. You understand? I told you all my hopes in Paris.
Alistair closed his eyes, as if the word Paris pained him.
Yes, he said. But you said, I thought, what did I say? I would not make any false promises. You know how it must be,
We are both men of the world.
I know, said Alistair, opening his eyes. He turned to look at Charles. It is only that I love you.
Cordelia inhaled sharply. Oh, Alistair.
Alistair's voice cracked as he spoke. Charles's voice cracked too, but his was not the sound of something breaking. It was the sound of a whip.
You absolutely cannot say that, Charles said. Not where someone might hear you. You know it, Alistair. No one can hear us, said Alistair. And I have loved you since Paris. I thought you loved me.
Charles said nothing, and for a moment, all Cordelia could think was that she hated Charles Fairchild for hurting her brother. Then she saw the infinitesimal tremble of Charles's hand as he put it in his pocket, and she realized that Charles might be scared too. Charles took a deep breath and crossed the carpeted floor to Alistair's side. Cordelia could see them both very clearly. Too clearly, perhaps, she thought, as Charles took his hands from his pockets and put them on her brother's shoulders. Alistair's lips parted slightly.
I do, Charles said. You know I do.
His hands slid up into Alistair's hair. He was still wearing gloves, his fingers dark against Alistair's pale hair. He drew Alistair in toward him and their lips met. Alistair made a soft sound like surrender. He slid an arm around Charles's neck and pulled him down onto the sofa. They stretched out together, Charles atop Alistair. It was Alistair's turn to bury his hands in Charles's hair, to press against Charles's body and fumble with his waistcoat. Charles's hands were flat against Alistair's chest, and he was kissing Alistair hungrily, over and over. Cordelia squeezed her eyes shut. This was her brother's life. His business, his very private business. Oh dear, she hadn't come for this at all. She could hear soft moans, could hear Alistair whispering to Charles in Persian, endearments she could never have imagined her brother uttering. There was a gasp. She would risk it, she decided. She would flee, and hopefully they would be too intent on each other to hear her. Then she heard Charles say, Alistair. I cannot. I cannot. There was a thumping sound, and Cordelia opened her eyes to see Alistair sitting dishevelled on the couch, and Charles standing, straightening his waistcoat. Alistair's jacket was thrown over the back of the sofa. Not now. Alistair no longer played music, but he still had a musician's hands. Cordelia watched as those hands lifted, twisted together in a brief instant of pain. And stilled.
What is wrong, Charles? He said, his voice husky and rough. If this is not what you came for, then why are you here? I thought you had accepted the situation with Ariadne, said Charles. I would not leave you, Alistair. We would still be what we are. And I thought that you would agree to marry too. That I would marry.
Alistair sprang to his feet.
I have told you over and over, Charles, even if I did not have you, I would never marry some poor woman and deceive her as to my love and regard. I have convinced my mother I can be of better use to the family and politics. You will find it difficult to succeed in politics without a wife, said Charles, and you do not need to deceive a woman.
Ariadne is an unusual case, said Alistair. If she did not prefer women, she would be unlikely to be willing to marry you.
Charles stood very still, his eyes fixed on Alistair's face. And if it were not Ariadne?
Alistair looked bewildered.
Speak sense, Charles. What do you mean?
Charles shook his head as if he were clearing away cobwebs.
Nothing, he said. I am unsettled. Much has happened this night, all of it bad.
Cordelia tensed. What did he mean?
He couldn't possibly know about their encounter with the demons at Battersea Bridge. Had someone else fallen ill?
Charles spoke in a heavy voice.
Barbara Lightwood has died.
Cordelia felt as if she had been punched in the stomach. She heard Alistair, as if from a distance, sounding stunned. Thomas's sister is dead.
I wouldn't have expected you to care, said Charles. I thought you hated those fellows.
No, said Alistair, surprising Cordelia. But Ariadne is all right.
She lives still, said Charles. But Raziel alone knows what will happen to any of them.
Alistair sat back down.
Perhaps we should leave London. It might not be safe here for Cordelia, for my mother.
Cordelia felt a jolt of surprise that her brother had thought of her. Alistair put his head in his hands.
Naimi Dunam, he whispered.
Charles looked blank, but Cordelia understood him.
I don't know. I don't know what to do.
We are shadow hunters, said Charles. And Cordelia wondered, did he not worry about Matthew falling ill? About Henry?
We do not run or spend our time in mourning. This is the time to fight and win. The Enclave will need a leader, and with my mother in Idris, now is the time for me to show them my best qualities.
He touched Alistair lightly on the shoulder. Alistair looked up, and Cordelia closed her eyes. There was something too personal about the way Alistair looked at Charles, all his defensiveness stripped away.
I must go, Charles said. But do not forget, Alistair, that whatever I do, it is with the thought of you ever in my mind.
Throw that back over here, Alexander, Lucy said in a low voice.
That was a small red rubber ball. Lucy's young cousin scooted along the marble floor of the library, but the ball bounced out of his reach and into Lucy's lap. Alexander looked mutinous.
Not fair, he said.
He was tired and fussy, as he had been awake for many hours past his usual bedtime. Lucy wasn't sure what time it was, exactly. She was sure many hours had passed since she had learned of Barbara's death, but it all seemed strangely like a bad dream, timeless and imprecise. Lucy glanced up and frowned.
Jessamine, don't take the child's ball from him. I just want to be included, Jessamine said.
She was drifting among the stacks, where Lucy had taken Alexander to amuse him, while his parents and hers huddled in conversation. At some point, Jessamine had appeared, sensitive to the unsettled feeling inside the Institute. She bobbed near Lucy, her long blonde hair unbound and floating.
Perhaps it is better for them to leave London, Tessa was saying.
She and Will sat with Lucy's Aunt Cecily and Uncle Gabriel at a long table in the centre of the big room. Green banker's lamps cast a soft glow over the room. It would be good for Sophie and Gideon to join Henry and Charlotte in Idris, for they are always a comforting presence, and surely being here at the moment will only remind them of Barbara. Lucy had seen her Uncle Gideon and Aunt Sophie only briefly when they had arrived to view Barbara's body and collect Thomas. Both had seemed hollowed out, like puppets in the shapes of her uncle and aunt, going through the motions of what was necessary. Still, they had tried to comfort Oliver, who sat sobbing beside Barbara's still body. She had thrashed and cried out at the last, it seemed, just before Tessa had arrived to find her dead. She had clawed Oliver's hands, and blood stained the white cuffs of his shirt and mixed with his tears. Oliver, devastated, was to return to York and his parents. Gideon and Sophie, it seemed, were headed to Idris, where Eugenia had collapsed on hearing the news of her sister's death and was not well enough to travel by portal. Thomas, though, would not be going with them. He had insisted on remaining in London and would be staying with Cecily and Gabriel at their home in Bedford Square.
We will take the best possible care of Thomas, said Cecily. Christopher will be so delighted to have him with us. But I cannot help but wonder if Thomas will regret not going to Idris. Surely it will be painful to be parted from his family at such a time.
You are also his family, said Will. Christopher and Thomas are like brothers, Ceci. I don't think he'll regret it, said Gabriel.
He was a kind uncle, but his aquiline features, like Anna's and Christopher's, made him look sterner than he was.
Thomas is much like Gideon, the type who must have something to do when tragedy strikes. Christopher wishes for his help in working on an antidote.
But Kit is just a boy, said Cecily. He should hardly be expected to accomplish something so monumental.
There is nothing to say that Christopher and Thomas's efforts will be in vain, said Will. We must all recall there was a time when the Clave doubted us and doubted Henry, and we prevailed.
Poor Sophie, said Jessamine unexpectedly. She was always such a kind girl, except for that time she hit me over the head with a mirror and tied me to my bed.
Lucy did not inquire further. Jessamine's stories usually ran the gamut from rambling to alarming. Instead, she pulled Alexander into her lap and rested her chin atop his head.
It seems to be the lot of the living to have tragedy visited upon them, Jessamine mused.
Lucy did not point out that the alternative seemed worse. Jessamine never seemed to wish she was alive. She seemed content in her role as ghost guardian.
So different from Jesse, Lucy thought.
Jesse, who had asked her to keep him a secret, so that his odd half-life would not be discovered and ended by the Clave. Jesse, who seemed to badly want to live.
We were all very brave then, said Tessa. I wonder sometimes if it is easier to be brave when one is young, before one truly knows how much there is to lose.
Cecily murmured something in response. Lucy hugged Alexander, who was half asleep in her arms, tightly. He was a comfort, despite being 3 years old and fussy. She felt somewhere in the core of her heart the truth of what her mother had just said. And one should put truth in books, she thought. But this would never be the sort of thing she put in the pages of the beautiful Cordelia. Books were about experiencing joy. This was the raw and awful stuff of life. It was much too terrible.
James was sitting at his writing desk, trying to read, but his eyes were skipping over the words on the page. He kept thinking of Barbara. He had not been extremely close with his cousin. The difference in age between them meant she regarded him indulgently as a child, as she did Thomas. But she had been there all his life, kind and cheerful, without her sister's sharp tongue, always expecting the ready best of everyone. He had never lived in a world without Barbara in it. Lucy was in the library, he knew, absorbing the company of others. But James had always found solace in books. Admittedly, not the kind of book he was reading currently, though. He had been surprised how very little material there was in the library on the princes of hell. They were not the kind of demons shadowhunters fought. In the mythology about them, they were the mirrors of angels like Raziel. Their interests seemed to go beyond humanity, who were like ants to them. Their battles were with angels and the rulers of realms, other worlds than Earth, dimensions the princes seemed to collect like chess pieces. They could not be killed, though sometimes they were able to wound each other in a manner that left the injured party weakened for years. There were 9 of them in total,